Hello there, bakeroos and bakerettes. Welcome to the Rise Up podcast. I'm your host, Mark Dick, and this is the show about bakers and bakeries and bakery owners and all the folks that work so hard, often through the night, to make the good stuff and share it with the people in their community. How are you this week? Good to talk to you again. My goodness, it's been a while, hey? I hope you enjoyed the Second Rise episodes that have been airing over the last few weeks while I've been off traveling. It was kind of neat to go down memory lane from my perspective and listen to some of the favorite episodes again. I hope it was the same for you. Today on the show, I talked to Andrew Janjigian, who is an awesome fella. He's a baker, he's a writer, he's a videographer, he's a teacher. He's done all kinds of stuff, and we talk about the whole gamut in our chat coming up in a couple of minutes. But first, a few updates. I had a really good trip. Well, Cindy and I both did, I think. A busy trip, a lot more work than we thought, but it was still really, really good. We went back to Saskatchewan for 2 weeks and dealt with a bunch of stuff that was left over from the big move out west. Mostly things left behind by our kids that we had to deal with. But, you know, we also sold our old car that was sitting in storage at my dad's farm, that kind of thing. And it was a chance to catch up with family and see them again, see Cindy's mom and dad, see my dad. We even drove up to Prince Albert to see my sister and her husband. That was fun, you know. And we got to visit some friends too. A lot of bread friends, actually. We on our way up to Prince Albert, we went to Saskatoon and saw our former baker, Tisha, and had a really good chat with her and talked to Tracy at Christie's Bakery in Saskatoon, talked to Bryn at Night Oven, talked to the sisters at Magpie's Kitchen in Regina, had two good visits with them. It was great fun. It was really good to catch up with everybody. But I have to say, it's good to be home, you know, and up until we got on the plane to fly to Saskatchewan, I was saying, yeah, we're flying home for 2 weeks. And now that I've done it and we're back on Vancouver Island, I'm thinking, yeah, no, I'm home now. This is home and it's great to be back. So that's kind of cool. You know, it's only been, well, it hasn't even been 2 years yet, just about 2 years since we moved out to the coast. And it's starting to feel like home now. So there you go. Good news in that vein. When I just went out for a walk and when I saw the water again, saw the mountains again, it felt pretty special. So there you go. Oh yeah. One last thing I want to mention before we get into the talk is, I think I need to have a standard corrections segment on the show where, you know, when I misspeak or change my mind on something, I have to come clean and talk about it on the podcast. One minor correction pointed out from our friend and chief geographer of the podcast, Martin Barnett, is that even my correction in the last episode about the ferry to Powell River from Vancouver Island was wrong, because I said it went from Nanaimo. It actually leaves from Courtney Comox. And that's the last I will discuss this subject, but at least I got it right, I think, finally. See, it may be home here, but it's still not... I don't know it like the back of my hand yet. And the other correction that I need to make is one of perception. And it's perception about the state of bread and baking in the city of Vancouver. We spent the last couple of days, when we flew home on our trip, we stayed in Vancouver with our son Ben for a few days and went touring around the city. And I always had this impression that there wasn't really much for bakeries in Vancouver and, you know, which is weird because it's one of Canada's great cities. It's one of the world's great cities. You know, it should have an awful lot of really good bakeries. But I think what I was finding was that whenever I went to Vancouver, I just stayed downtown, you know, and hung around downtown and there wasn't as much there. But if you get out of downtown to where, you know, folks like Ben live, there's a ton of really good bakeries. We went for a walk around the Olympic Village area and loaded down our packs with bread and pastries from all the little shops that we we met around there and sort of stumbled across, eating ice cream as we went. Did a long hike up Main Street in Vancouver, and we're just blown away by the shops along there, like even two to three, you know, in the same general block or two, you know, there would be a lovely cake and pastry shop, and then across the street, a good bread place, and, you know, and then another place that was more of a bakery cafe, and they all seemed to be humming on last Saturday afternoon. And then on Sunday, Ben took us out to Commercial Drive, which is another strip in Vancouver that's full of restaurants, and it's kind of the Little Italy area of Vancouver. And so there are cappuccino bars and restaurants and stuff, but everything's a blend there. It's a very multicultural city, and there was a blend of shops from all cultures and restaurants and little bakeries and stuff. And so we stopped in at a, you know, real rootin' tootin' boulangerie on Commercial Drive and had a good time there as well. So we bought so much bread and baking while we were in Vancouver that I had to leave half of it with Ben and brought half of it back on the ferry because it was just too much to carry. So much for Vancouver not having good bakeries. They have amazing bakeries there. And you really should visit if you have a chance to visit the city. It's a pretty cool place, and it's really bustling. It's really moving. Where I live is a little more laid back and mellow, even though I think there's lots going on here. It's a whole other level when you head back to the mainland and spend some time in Vancouver. There you go. So it's the bakery and tour guide podcast this week. All right, on to the main talk with Andrew Janjigian. So Andrew, I've known him through the Bread Bakers Guild for years and years, you know, swapped emails, you know, on the chat group, that kind of a thing. But I just recently started getting his newsletter called Word Loaf. It's geared kind of it's geared for home bakers and gets into the details of bread baking and the intricacies of bread baking with awesome stories and that kind of thing. You know, for home bakers to perfect the craft at a home baking scale. And when I dug into Word Loaf and then I started looking around a little bit more, I realized, oh man, Andrew's into all kinds of stuff, from teaching at King Arthur Flour to making videos on YouTube and Serious Eats to a past career with Cooks Illustrated and America's Test Kitchen. And we talk about all of that stuff. And because it's a Rise Up podcast, we start talking about the weather. And I edited most of it out, but right when we start the talk here, we're just wrapping up a chat about the incredible heat wave that was passing over North America back in July before we get on to pizza and other good, tasty things. So here we go. A really fun chat with my new friend, Andrew Janjigian from Massachusetts. He lives in the Boston area. There you go. Yeah, well, I'm glad you're good. I loved your newsletter because it's I loved how you phrase it. Yeah, there's all sorts of stuff you can do when it's cold, when your dough is too cold, but when it starts getting too hot, and everything around it is even hotter. It's a scary time.
It's a big challenge, and I don't know. Maybe there's a market in a book on how to bake in tropical weather.
Yeah, maybe
for the future.
Yeah, well, because they always talk about tropical baking is hard because of the local flour or whatever, but there'd be lots more to it as well, for sure.
Yeah, I do field questions from people that live in the tropics about, you know, using my recipes or any recipes, and it's definitely something, initially, I would say, yeah, I have no idea, I don't have that problem, but actually... And now that I'm realizing that I do, I used to like take August off of baking bread just because it was a pain in the butt. But now I'm thinking that I need to probably expand on that piece at some point and do some more experimentation around it. I'm not just suggest things, but try things out.
Yeah. It's funny, you know, I know you through the guild and mm-hmm. emails and stuff over the years and all of that, but I never really knew kind of what you did and how you fit in the whole fabric of things until just, you know, a couple months ago, because I stumbled across uh-huh. I stumbled across Wordloaf, the Instagram page, and it was like, okay, this is pretty cool. And then, I don't know, flipped through somehow, I was like, oh man, you're seriously involved in the teaching side of things, and also sort of that I don't know, publication side of things, like with all the Cook's Illustrated and stuff. How did you get into that world?
So it's a kind of a convoluted path that I took. I started out my culinary career in the sort of savory line cook side of things.
Okay.
I started out initially working in restaurants in front of the house working as a waiter, but I had already started, and that was as like a teenager just into college, and I'd already also started, you know, fooling around in the kitchen and wanting to learn to cook at that point. And so I had an opportunity at one point at a restaurant to jump back from the front of the house to the back of the house, you know, a chef that like encouraged me to try being garde manger and seeing where it might lead. And then I ended up working in restaurants in New York City, where I was in school, for about 5 years.
Oh, okay.
And worked my way up the ladder to working in a pretty good restaurant as sous chef, and I really loved it, but I got kind of burnt out as a young person working in restaurants. It was a lot of fun, but that fun can take its toll as well.
Yeah.
And I grew up in Boston, and I moved back here, and I did a little bit of cooking at that point, but then I decided I wanted to rethink what I was up to, and had studied at school. I had studied liberal arts and art and film and literature, but I had been pretty good at sciences in high school, but never really thought of myself as pursuing the sciences as an adult. But then I realized that I had sort of missed out on something that I liked to do. And so I decided to go back to school and potentially go to med school.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I just had this, you know, I kind of had an interest in neuroscience at the time and thought, oh, maybe med school would be interesting. And I now, looking back, think the whole idea of that would be absurd. I'm too kind of ADD to ever like do one thing full time for as long as it would take
right.
to get to that. So, but what happened was I started because I hadn't taken all the courses I would need to get into medical school. I had to do like a quick pre-med track locally, you know, at sort of extension school program. And the first few classes I took were chemistry.
Okay.
And I had never really paid any attention to chemistry before, even though I'd done it in high school.
Yeah.
But I like instantly fell in love with the science of it, and also the sort of kind of cooking aspect.
Okay.
Like I found myself very adept at like conceptually understanding what's happening, and also being able to put a bunch of ingredients in a container or heat them up and turn them into something else,
yeah.
which is cooking in a nutshell. And then I was just fortunate to at that point get a job or get a paid internship at a local biotech company.
Okay.
Through a connection. I was like, I need, you know, it'd be fun to have a chemistry related job while I'm doing these classes. I got this internship. They saw my aptitude at doing the work. And it was organic chemistry, drug development type work. And they renewed my internship several times. And finally I got a full-time job there as a chemist.
Cool.
And that lasted for 12 years.
Wow.
So I got kind of waylaid into the science that I was kind of turned out to be most interested in and most good at. And And so I sort of backed away from cooking, at least professionally, but I continued to cook all that time, obviously. Right. You know, it's sort of been a passion as a kid, and I come from a family of very good cooks, and so it was always there. And yeah. And so after 12 years of that, I sort of about 4 or 5 years before I stopped working there, left that field, I got the bread bug, and that was through, which is not something I'd ever really thought about, except in one way, in that the first thing I ever learned to cook as a teenager, probably like 13, 14, was pizza. And it was something I was obsessed with. So, and it's something I've been obsessed with ever since then. So like bread had always been a part of my world, but only in the form of pizza, and never like a loaf. I'm sure I'd baked some, but I never really thought about or seemed to care about. Like I lived in Paris for a semester in college, and I spent more time in museums and darkened movie theaters than I did going to bakeries, which now in retrospect I regret. but it was the you know, the Leahy Bittman no need bread that turned me on to the fact that like good bread was something that you could make at home. That's and so it was cool. Something I wanted to do. And so kind of as I got into bread baking, I started to and sort of started to apply my science background and my laboratory skill set to, you know, improving recipes. I started to think about working in food again.
Yeah.
And just coincidentally, I mean, I feel like a lot of things in my life have happened this way. Just coincidentally, I met somebody who was like the friend of a friend of a friend who worked at America's Test Kitchen.
Okay.
And, you know, I told her my story and she said, geez, you should work at, you should apply here because we would love, you're exactly the kind of person that we, you know, try to find. And, you know, somebody with a background in food and in sciences and an ability to write, which wasn't something I thought I had, but at least I had a training in literature. And I think the writing part is something that I'm still working on, but it was the last piece to fall into place.
Well, because you're, I've done a little bit of work in the past with, you know, deeply technical people, and, and that, the bridge, the folks that have the discipline to, you know, to be a chemist and to take that sort of scientific approach and bring it into another field is one thing, but then you have to be able to talk about it or write about it or communicate it out and get it out to regular folks, you know? And, that's a great combination. Like that's a gift in a way, right? When you can do it, it's awesome. But it's not as common as you might think.
No, it isn't. Especially if you read a lot of scientific literature, you know how bad the writing can be or how dry it can be. And sometimes that's fine, but you know, there's a level of inspiring people to understand something. So that requires being whatever. You don't have to be poetic necessarily, but you have to get them to listen to you.
Yeah, get them engaged, right? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And that's something that I find it challenging, but I'm always grateful when people say that I got my ideas across in a way that made sense.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, it's interesting that you brought up sort of pizza as the gateway into the whole thing.
Yes.
It's one of the things I've learned is East Coast US, like there's some pretty strong regional factions of pizza opinion, you know, like that kind of thing.
For sure.
So you take it seriously, like, cause I got my start, you know, more as in high school, like the pizza was the thing that I made at home, but it's like, there wasn't like there was
styles of pizza around. There was the craft box that you bought right. to start with, right? And the Greek guys in town.
So is there a Greek pizza thing yeah. out there too?
In Regina. In Regina, where I grew up, a lot of Greek immigrants, and pretty much all the restaurants are Greek restaurants, and some are like mm-hmm. authentic Greek and some are owned right. by Greek families, but it's like the same kind of thing. And there was a guy, so in the 70s, Houston Pizza, right by where I used to live, they kind of invented this, you know, new style of pizza, which is essentially like about that much meat, you know, like an inch and a half of meat, cheese on top of that, you know, and like just the meal in the soggy meal kind of a thing. But wow. that, you know, real thick crust, Regina style pizza. And I remember I have some American cousins and they would come up and we'd go for pizza and they were like, what the heck is this? Right. Like what? it's like, they say, like, first off, you know, for them, it was like toppings were supposed to go on top of the cheese, right? And in Saskatchewan anyways, no, the cheese is the last thing you put on and it's lots of it. But then we were always like, no, the toppings go on top of the sauce. That was the deal, right? But yeah, it was actually until I traveled around Canada a little bit, I realized, oh no, it was kind of a unique yeah. style of pizza. I wouldn't call it good. And I don't really crave it or miss it or anything. Although, you know, you go home and you have one of those home style Greek pizzas. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Well, so that's interesting because, Boston, as a rule, is not known for its pizza. There are okay. exceptions. There are a couple of good places, but actually most of it is not very good. And up until recently, at least, most of the pizzerias here were also owned by Greek families.
Yeah.
Greek people. And I don't know if there's any overlap, but the style, I mean, New England is actually known for Greek pizza, style of pizza, which is a pan. It's baked in a pan.
Yep.
It's sort of, it's a little bit puffy. It's kind of, it's oiled and there's yep. some shortening on the pan and it's kind of crunchy on the bottom.
Yep.
And, the cheese is like a mixture of mild cheddar and mozzarella. So it's okay. a little tangy and the sauce is a little on the sweet side. And most of them are, you know, a kind of mediocre and the sort of thing that unless you grew up on it, you wouldn't recommend it to somebody else. But there's a couple of places that make it really well. And I would even encourage like outsiders to have. So
yeah, there that's sounds very similar. Similar.
That's interesting.
Yep, done in a pan, crunchy on the bottom. And then in our town anyways, there's sort of like three families that started a bunch of chains, right? And so you know, there's the Houston Pizza style. I love the name Houston Pizza, Western Pizza, and Trifon's. And uh-huh. and I think if you go back to the 70s, they were all either brothers or cousins that's then branched out and did their own. And you know, for me, they're unique amongst the three. Right. And maybe to an outsider not so much. But yeah, like the restaurants at home, it was like you would all the restaurants would sell pizza. You could get souvlaki. You could get, Greek salad, souvlaki, pizza, lemon chicken. That was the thing. And if you wanted mm-hmm. to pay, if you wanted to go on a date, you went to the Chimney or the Lakeshore and you paid the more money for the same thing, but you had to dress up.
Okay.
Or you'd get exactly the same thing for half the price, just going to the family style restaurant, but the menus, you know, a very standard menu across the board. Right. Yeah. It was funny. And do you guys have spinach and feta pizza?
I think that you'd see feta and black olives and things like that on the sort of optional toppings.
Yeah. Cause that was the fourth place, it's called the Copper Kettle. They were kind of known for their that was the pizza, spinach and feta cheese with then mozzarella. Memories. I'm going home in a while.
How are you?
Hopefully in August we're going back home, and now I'm getting hungry. But no, that's really neat. The start then, I guess, for you in that sort of bread and media world was America's Test Kitchen then? Was that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so when I made the switch to working there, I was already well into my like obsession with baking bread.
Yeah.
A little bit before I moved there. I went to the kneading conference. Just kind of, I think I read about it in the New York Times and said, wait, this is in my backyard, even though it's kind of a long drive from here. I need to be there. And
yeah.
So I went to the next summer's one and, you know, met the whole core of teachers and,
yeah,
and bakers that hang out at places like that. And started like taking classes at places like King Arthur Flour, and elsewhere, and, you know, really sort of started to focus on my repertoire. I think I built a small cob oven at the before then too. Yeah. You know, thinking it would be for doing pizza parties and stuff in the backyard and maybe baking some bread. And so I was already pretty far along the way in my bread thing. And so when I got there, you know, I was able to kind of occupy a niche that nobody else did, which was the kind of the person who was obsessed with bread. Like everyone there tends to have like their thing that they're really good at, even though we all were tasked with doing recipes of all kinds because the magazine never focuses entirely on bread.
Right.
I'd say we, you know, about maybe 10 to 15% of the recipes in a given year would be bread related. The rest would be desserts and dinners and entrees and side dishes. And so you really had to be able to cook everything. But once they realized that I was into bread, they would send those recipes my way. And so I would say I did about, you know, half of the recipes in the magazine, the bread recipes during the time I was there, just because they like to play to people's strengths. And so that gave me an opportunity to really dig deep on things that either I already knew how to do, but wanted to know better or had never really done before. And so while I was there, I developed maybe, I don't know, 2-3 dozen between flatbreads, pizzas, and loaf breads, 2-3 dozen recipes, and sort of developed a reputation as the bread, the in-house bread guy.
Yeah.
I also, like, you know, was still learning things, but I was able to kind of parlay my position there into an opportunity to then flip and start teaching some of these things. And so, yeah, you know, I've been taking classes at King Arthur, and one time I was up there, I said, you know, I developed recipes for breads for Cooks Illustrated. You know, how would you feel about me maybe coming up and teaching? And they were game to give it a try. And so that's where I started teaching. And I've taught at the kneading conference a few times. And,
right.
I didn't really, I didn't until then, you know, I wanted to get paid to make bread or get paid to go to these places instead of having to pay to go to this.
Yeah, yeah,
and
sure.
So, but I never thought of myself as like being a teacher or wanting to be a teacher, but actually it's one of my favorite things to do is to, especially in person, which is something, you know, those of us who do it have probably all been missing for a while, but there's something really just fun for me to, both to interact with bakers and people who are enthusiastic about the thing, and also to use teaching as an opportunity to figure out what you know. Like, before you can teach something, you have to know how you know it or how well you know it.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I find that the newsletter and writing for other people is another form of that. It's like, okay, here's a thing that I think I know, but I want to make sure I do. I want to know where the gaps in my knowledge are. And so by being forced to sit down with it and figure it out and to try to articulate it for other people gives you an opportunity to.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and
together.
Yeah. And the I'm assuming the science discipline too, to say like, you know, is this a repeatable thing that I've seen?
Yeah.
And if it's repeatable, then I'll talk about it, you know, as opposed to it worked for me once, which I fall into. It's like, oh, I did this. It worked this one time. I might work again. You know? Yeah. Because that's interesting to me, the developing recipes, because I don't know that sort of test kitchen from a magazine perspective, but I remember it from the PBS show that I used to watch on Saturday afternoons, right? Where it'd be right. And I saw an article of yours online this week about an older one about soufflés, and sort of like, okay, you know, we're going to crack the code on soufflés here. What's going on, right? And I love that approach, saying, well, you know, okay, let's talk about let's define what success looks like. Okay, you know, in the soufflé case, remember, it's got to be cheesy, it's got to be tall. Okay, now how are we going to pull this off? You know, in a way that's got a lot high probability of success for someone like me, right? And
there's so many pieces.
Yeah,
there's so many pieces to it. First, the first goal is to just like perfect the recipe.
Yeah.
And there's something, I still feel like I have this, but maybe not as much because I have to maybe work on a slightly quicker pace than I did when there. But having the freedom to like spend a month on a recipe and really like mess it up many times and not have it matter that you're quote unquote wasting food. I mean, usually everything got eaten, even if they were the failures.
Right.
But it's really kind of, you know, a rare thing to be able to dig that deep into something. But once you kind of perfect something that you as a professional can do, then the question is, how can you translate that to the home cook?
Right.
And that's something that, I think about, because I spend a lot of time with real professional bakers who have bakeries or teach bakers. And so I've always kind of questioned, well, where do I stand? Am I as good as them, or do I have some to get across that they don't necessarily, or that they, that is complementary to what they have to offer. And I think, you know, I come back to this idea that like, it's, I understand both sides of the equation. I understand what it means to how you do that kind of work, because I've spent so much time with bakers. And I also understand how you make food in your home kitchen, and how people who are not excellent cooks can still succeed if they're given the right set of tools, information, and guidance on how to pull things off. So a lot of what I read about in the newsletter is how you can make things at home that look like things that were made in a bakery. And you don't necessarily employ the same strategies to do that. And that's something that I think that not a lot of people kind of get.
Sure. Oh yeah. Well, and even the fact that you're making one or two as opposed to trying to set up, you know, production. Yeah. Makes a difference for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. And there's the scale difference, but there's also the, like, if you have to make 100 loaves of bread a day, you're going to get good at that really fast compared to somebody who makes a loaf once a week or once a month or whatever it is. And so
totally.
How do you, one of the things I think about a lot is how to encourage people not to like go from one recipe to the next serially, but to like, if you want to get good at this, you need to like master a basic skill set before you start branching out or trying to, and like, you should just repeat the same basic loaf over and over again until you like know it by heart. And then not only will you have that recipe down, but you'll probably also be, you'll have gained the kind of intuition that you need to be a good baker. Yep. And then moving on from there is much easier than just bouncing around.
Yeah. Yeah, because you've got some sort of foundational knowledge in your hands, like in your skin, right? Like
exactly,
that you can build on. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Like I spent a lot of time thinking about what it means to think like a baker. Like you know, what is the mindset of a baker, or what is what's the mindset of a loaf of bread? Because like, it's not just.
Yep.
You know, it's a living thing, right? Even with or without the ferment in it, it's a living thing. Mm-hmm. It evolves and it behaves a certain way, and you have to really like get inside of it to do well with it. Yeah. And that's something that's hard to teach, but I still feel like articulating it is helpful for beginners.
Well, cause there's that sense of nervousness like about things that you don't really understand. And you know, I think when you start, you've got 100 things to be nervous about, and then it reduces down to something more manageable. Cause I was thinking about that, cause it's been, you know, it's been kind of weird for me moving out to the coast here and going from, you know, if I was baking, I was going to bake, you know, a full batch for my brick oven. You know, I'm going to bake 16 loaves or probably 3 batches kind of a thing. To now it's like, well, I've got, thanks to Jim, I've got my Challenger bread pan and, I'm going to make 4 loaves, you know, because I have room in the fridge for 3 baskets and the one I'm baking and
right.
get a cycle going. And so, but just that reminder, like, hey, you're mixing by hand. You can be patient with this. You can give it an extra fold if it needs it. You don't have to jam an extra fold in, like, you just that, because over time you get that confidence. But I was thinking back to, you know, when I first started, like say, you know, before I even went to SFBI and that, and it was like, you get all nervous about what it is that you can actually change now, you know? And it's like, I think it needs can I give it an extra fold, or can I put it in the fridge for a bit, or whatever it happens to be. And there's so much tension builds up that I don't know how you can see repeatable results until you get some reps in and just relax a little bit too. So I believe sure. it. Yeah.
The other thing that's, I think, you know, a lot of people come to baking, or they would say most people probably come to baking bread from with some experience and confidence doing other kinds of recipes, you know, cooking steak or making salads or whatever. And I think more than any other type of cooking, baking requires a kind of resilience and flexibility that, you know, you can't just follow a recipe. Having come from working in a magazine and now writing recipes for myself, you know, you try to write a recipe that gives you all the information you need, but like you know with bread that like it's not just do it for X amount of time until Y happens and then move on to the next step. It's do it for, you know, this range of time and pay attention and look for these things, and maybe it'll happen in 2 hours, maybe it'll 4 hours, and maybe it'll look one way one day and another way another day. Neither one of those is wrong necessarily.
Yeah.
It's really hard to get that across. So again, it's one of those things where like before you even have somebody reading that recipe, you need to give them the, like, you know, remind them that they need to just be just relaxed. Yeah. As you said, they need to be chill about the journey. It's a journey and it's not always going to work. I mean, I know for me, I mean, I think of myself as a pretty good baker, but I have failures all the time. And I know that it's even true in professional settings. So for an average home cook to fail is nothing. It's not a big deal. But it can be discouraging nevertheless.
It can, absolutely. You know, especially, you know, you get 3 successes and then you get a bomb. You think, I got this figured out. And it's like, something happens, but you know, you could have a heat, sourdough. And knock you out. Oh yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Sourdough is fickle. And you really, you know, even you can never bake a loaf of bread and you still like could spend a lot of time getting to know your starter and making sure it's healthy. No matter what the temperatures are. Or your ability to feed. So there's a lot to think about.
Well, and that's what I think, you know, hopefully we're going to get back to face-to-face meetups and stuff again soon, because there's nothing better than, you know, than actually seeing it live, getting your hands in the mixer, feeling the thing, absolutely. You know, that kind of deal. Yeah. So tell me a bit about Word Loaf. Like when did you start that The newsletter.
So that's another one of those kind of curious tales, and also like where it exists. And I don't work at America's Test Kitchen because of the reason it exists. It was sort of and it has to do with COVID as well too.
Okay,
it's kind of a strange thing that to say that like something positive for me at least came out of something that's so generally so terrible. Right. I'm sure I'm not the only person that has, found a new avocation because of just the seismic shifts that we all have gone through. But what happened was that at the beginning of lockdown, we got sent home to start working, in our home kitchens. And at the time, one of my colleagues was working on a bread recipe. And we were having, first or second day of meeting as a team over Zoom to talk about the state of our recipe projects. And she mentioned having a hard time finding yeast and flour at the supermarket, which now everyone, that's the story that we all went through. And so I jokingly said, It was an oatmeal roll recipe with yeast. And I jokingly said, we should make the recipe sourdough. At least that way people wouldn't need to find yeast at the supermarket. They could skip one of the hard to find things. And that was just a joke because we rarely do. I've done one sourdough recipe for the magazine in the 12 years that I was there. But then I thought, if you can't get flour, how are you going to start a sourdough starter to make a recipe out of? And I thought, would it be interesting if you could make a sourdough starter using instead of the daily feedings of your nascent starter with a cup of flour, what if it was just a teaspoon of flour? What if it was 10 grams of flour instead of 100 or 250? And it was just kind of an offhand thing, but I thought that would kind of be interesting. Let's see what happens. So I have flour, and so I mixed up a flour and water of 10 grams each and stuck it in a jar. And the next day, or 24, 36 hours later, it was bubbly and active. And I, so I posted a picture of it on my Instagram feed, and I said, I gave it a clever punny name. I called it the Quarantini Starter. And people thought it was funny, and maybe a few people at the time thought it was kind of cool. But somebody at the America's Test Kitchen or Cooks Illustrated social media team thought it was interesting enough that she shared it on their feed.
Okay.
And because people were stuck at home and looking for something to do, they thought, that could be fun. I'll try that too. I don't have yeast. I can't have yeast. And so it became this mini movement, and within and I kept posting updates to it and following it along, and within about 3 weeks I probably had 500 600 people that were doing it as well. And I lost track in the end how many people actually were doing it, but it was probably more than 1,000. And meanwhile, whether or not all of these other people were actually doing it and following along, I was getting all this interest in it. Instagram following kind of skyrocketed. And so it sort of became a thing. And eventually I got a starter that was strong enough to leaven bread. And I started posting pictures of other people's loaves that they were making with their own. So it became a thing, but what happened was at some point I was finding it unwieldy to use Instagram to convey information to people.
Sure, totally.
To give them recipes and stuff. And so I had heard about this kind of newsletter thing that had been around for a while, but it was just starting to also snowball at that point. And I thought, maybe I'll just start a newsletter and I can use that as the kind of clearinghouse for what people, the information people were asking for. And so I just, on my Instagram feed, I just said, hey, I just created a newsletter. Come over there, join me. And it'll be a good way for people to communicate with me, and I can send out daily updates that way, and I can help you troubleshoot and all this. And so, you know, within a couple of days, I had several thousand people subscribing to the newsletter. And it became a thing. And I was still doing posts on Instagram, but I had a community of people already there.
Yeah.
That was about a month after, I had the idea to do the tiny starter. So I don't want to go too much into this aspect of it, but as it turned out, America's Test Kitchen, certain people there were not happy with the idea of me publishing, quote unquote, publishing on an alternative platform.
Right.
I tried to convince people there that that what I was doing was something that like made the most sense to do there, because it was a very easy way for me to keep up with the flood of kind of requests for information and the sort of natural need to publish daily updates. And but they weren't going for it. And so they asked me to shut the newsletter down and move sort of the information and the posts that I had made to the website at America's Test Kitchen. And so, you know, I like my job. I didn't want to lose my job. And so I did as asked, but in the back of my mind, I thought, this is kind of interesting. I don't want to really lose this audience. And so what I did was I shut down the newsletter without actually, I just basically turned it off without deleting anything.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
And I thought maybe there's an opportunity for me to reboot this at some point. And then a couple of months later, like in the middle of the summer, early summer of last year, the platform that I was using is called Substack.
Yep.
It's one of the bigger newsletter platforms. They put out a call for a fellowship they were offering, which was they were going to give a small handful of people a bunch of money to let them like kind of grow their audience and maybe go independent if they weren't independent. And so on a fluke, I just applied, and I sort of played up the fact that like I had had a newsletter, it had a huge audience, but it didn't, but I wasn't able to follow through with it. I sort of have this thing that I'd like to do something with. And as it turns out, they like, you know, either they like the newsletter or they like the story of the newsletter. And I got one of these fellowships and so I decided, you know, given that and like some in the background I've been thinking about or reaching out to other places to potentially do some freelance writing as a way of like kind of supplementing whatever income I would be able to get from the newsletter. And so I lined up freelance work, and then I just decided I'm going to take advantage of this fellowship, and I quit my job at America's Test Kitchen. And so that's the story of it. And when I rebooted, which was, you know, at the end of last summer, I decided it wasn't going to just be about how to create a starter out of small amounts of flour. Yeah. It's going to be just like every aspect of bread baking for a home baker and whatever, like either whatever's on my mind or whatever's on their minds. It's a combination of both. It doesn't really have a through line other than that. It's, you know, sometimes I talk about very, very kind of granular aspects of baking. And sometimes I'll talk about heady, broader topics like where you should be buying your flour from, or should you be milling your own flour, or things like that. But over time, looking back on it, I did a kind of like recently did a kind of index of it for people so they could find posts more easily. And that'll give me an opportunity to kind of look back over the last 9 months or so of posts. And there is something that ties them all together. And I think what it is sort of like how to be a home baker.
Yeah.
You know, how to make good bread at home. And there's a lot of different ways that manifests. It's really fun. I didn't I started it a year ago. I had no idea that it was going to be anything. And now it's become a major source of my time and a pretty substantial part of my income. Also given me opportunity to do way more free, more interesting freelance work. Like nowadays I'm doing almost entirely bread content. So whereas America's Test Kitchen, I was doing 10% of my time was on bread. Now, just about everything. The only other major component of what I'm up to that isn't always bread related, but sometimes is too, is Armenian recipes, because that's my background.
Is Armenian. Right. Okay.
And so I'm developing recipes for serious eats mostly. Which obviously, as my heritage, it is something that I'm passionate about.
So sure.
Able to delve into that deeply as well.
Awesome. Oh yeah. Well, the really interesting story, and I didn't know the backstory with America's Test Kitchen, but it's actually, as a phenomena though, that's something I've been really interested in the last while, for a long time now, actually, is the media companies have relationships with their writers, and then the writers are forming their own audience, and kind of how does that play out, right? You know, and you've got, well, and thinking even in our world, right? So like, Peter Reinhardt, you know, is teaching at Johnson and Wales and has this entire army of Peter Reinhardt fans for his books and stuff, right? You know, and it's, and they both coexist, but it seems like everyone, it's a fluid space, right? It's not that, well, this is how it works all the time, you know? And
it's clear there's a bunch of different ways to have a platform and an audience.
Yeah.
You know? And also I'm learning that, you know, I mean, at least for me, and I realize that it's a privilege. But I have a relatively small paying readership, but in terms of numbers, but it's enough to make a difference. And you don't need to like have a million followers to actually have an audience that needs you. Like there is competition, but it doesn't have to be like the 700 or so people that pay for my newsletter. They might also pay for other people's newsletters, or they might only be paying for me, but I don't need to compete against other bakers. And that fits in perfectly because bakers generally are generous people. Generous and cooperate, you know, we share between each other. Like that's the thing, you know, aside from the bread and the practice of making bread, one of the things I love about being in the baking world is the generosity and joy that we all take in. Like that's what places like Wheatstalker,
totally,
conference, just hanging out and sharing and just talking bread all day long. I mean, that I don't, you know, I think it's probably that way in some places in the culinary end of things. When it comes to bakers, it's like, that's the default mode.
Yeah. You're dead on. And you're exactly right. It's like, it's not about how many people, you know, this podcast is exactly the same thing, you know, like to me, there are so many people that listen to this show. I can't believe that many people listen to this show. In the whole scheme of things, nobody listens to this show, right? You know, but it's like, right. but within this, you know, particular community, it's awesome. And a subset of those folks are supporting the show financially to help pay the costs and stuff. And it's like, and it's the absolute best. And it's incredible to me that it even happens. And yet that's the generosity of the place, and it keeps you going. So yeah, it's, you don't need a million for sure. You know, it's like, a thousand is an amazing number, you know, like that's fantastic. Yeah. Yeah. Well, but it's true though. And also it kind of speaks to the bakers being generous folks. And I think about that a lot. You know, I noticed, like, I love your t-shirt. That's from Nate's place, break bread, right? Yeah,
exactly. Yeah,
and we're buddies, and I just love everything that he does, and
yeah,
there's such a strong community focus to the work that he does, and yet, so you know, yeah, like he's charging money for his products, but he's helping in the community. And he's helping other bakers out, and that's the whole network around here, right? Like everybody's, there's so much sharing and generosity on all levels that I love it. Can't get enough. Yeah.
It's addicting, and it's a bummer not to get to spend time with people during all this.
I have a Wheatstock T-shirt from the last one, 2018, that I still wear. Uh-huh. And you know how they post all the names of the presenters and stuff on the back, right? And so every week I do laundry and I fold the shirt and I read the names and I'm like, okay, what, one day we will meet again. It won't be long.
Sorry, we didn't get to know each other at that one. That was a fun one.
I was just I was blossoming out of my super shy mode. Because it's certainly in the life of the podcast, it was so stupid, but I had done three episodes but hadn't published them yet, but I had recorded them. Mm-hmm. And I actually rented a little mini recorder and some mics and took them to Rhode Island thinking, I'll get up the nerve and I'll, hey Andrew, come on, we'll sit down and we'll come over here and we'll do a little mini interview and stuff. And I didn't have the guts to do it. But I did some of the first interviews that I did with folks that I didn't know personally first. I came out of Wheatstock. Like I remember I cornered Don Guerra at one of the community nights. I said, you know, love your stuff. I've got this podcast. I want you to come on. He goes, okay, email me. And so we talked a few weeks later and I made the rounds, would trap people in stairwells. And so I sort of, I think the first dozen episodes after I got back were all folks that, like, you know, I met Nate. That's how I met Nate, we shared a ride from the hotel to the venue kind of thing. And got to know him.
That's where I met him too. Was at that one.
But next one on whatever coast, I'm going to get there for sure. So hopefully it won't be too much longer. Like we're at level three of reopening here now in BC today. Right. Mm-hmm. So, and there's only one more to go. So they're saying by September we'll be good. And it's all based on, you know, numbers of vaccinations and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So it's coming. It won't be too long now, but yeah. So cool. Well, hey, I did want to ask you just one question about the freelance work that you're doing now. Is that kind of like Serious Eats an example of that? Like these little media things that are popping up?
Yeah. So I'd say the two biggest venues are King Arthur Flower and Serious Eats. And at King Arthur, my focus is on obviously flour related things, not just bread. We're talking about doing more or branching out there and doing pieces on noodles and pasta and dumplings and things like that, but anything that uses their flours. And for a while I was working with Martin Phillip, who's a good friend of mine, and and we were doing like tag teaming around very like monthly themed monthly themes, like we did one on bagels and one on brioche and pizza, and you know, he would do a recipe and I would write the sort of the overview of the process that people use, and you know, give tips and tricks, things like that. And we're kind of stepping back from that, and now I'm just going to be writing on things that are of interest to me. They're not going to be doing the theme things as much. But I love working for them. I've taught there for years now, and I'm a huge fan of their, I'm always pushing their flowers on people. I think if you haven't made the leap into, fresh milled or local flowers, then that's the flower I always tell people to work with. Yeah. And I, you know, I'm a fan of the company and the people that work there. And so I'm really happy to be a part of that. And then I have zero seats for Armenian, but also other random things that I could potentially, like I'm going to do a German pretzel recipe for them pretty soon. And then I have a new thing in the works for the fall that isn't 100% set yet, but it should be another big venue for me to do some interesting stuff that will be potentially bread related, but not necessarily. So, but the beauty is that I have more opportunities for work than I have time for.
That's awesome.
It's an ideal situation.
If you're capable of saying no, that's a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
I'm not so good at that.
Well, in the beginning when I first started, because I really started doing the freelance work seriously in early January. And for 3 months there, I was saying yes to everything because mostly because everything was interesting, not just because I felt like I had to get the work, but it was interesting. And so it was kind of a long winter. Now I'm backing off a little bit, but I'm still pretty busy.
Awesome.
So yeah, I'm happy. And the newsletter, you know, I try not to neglect that because it's such an important piece of things. And there are people there, they, you know, there are things that people have asked for months and months ago that I haven't yet supplied. So I have a long to-do list on the newsletter.
Right on. Cool. Well, hey, thanks a lot and good luck.
Yeah.
I'm going to keep an eye on both the newsletter, but also the Serious Eats work that you're doing because I don't know anything. I really don't know anything about our Armenian culture and Armenian food. So I'm curious to see, to learn about that.
Yeah. Well, sure. I'm grateful there too, because I get, because I worked at America's Test Kitchen for so long and I have like, you know, I have the skill set and a sort of an authority to be able to create recipes in a kind of that people can rely on. Mm-hmm. And now I have a platform to do that, to apply that to my own culture, which, you know, there's nobody else with that background who's also Armenian. So I feel like I'm lucky that I get to.
Yeah.
And there's a whole world of recipes that nobody knows really outside of it. So it's exciting to bring those to people.
Absolutely.
And we have some great breads too. Armenians are pretty serious about their bread. So
Yeah, absolutely. The more of that, the better for sure. I find there's a whole world out there that I don't know anything about. you know, food culture wise, that kind of thing, and it's certainly we're all better if we can kind of dip into all of that stuff. You know,
absolutely, yeah,
for sure. Cool. Well, thank you so much. Thanks again, and really appreciate
it's
the talk.
Yeah, my pleasure. I really love the podcast and I appreciate you and what you do and your approach to this world and to the people you interview. So I'm honored to be a part of it.
Thanks a bunch. Well, that was a lot of fun, wasn't it? What a great guy. A really interesting career path to get him to what he's doing now from, you know, culinary through medical school, through the hard sciences to a life of a writer and a teacher and a baker. So that's pretty cool. And I appreciated the chat towards the end there when we were talking about sort of building platforms and having our viewers or our listeners or our readers help us on this journey. You know, in the same way when you're running a bakery, you know, if there's no one there to buy your products, the bakery can't last forever, right? And it's the same thing with writers and teachers and that kind of thing. And so I like what Andrew's doing with the free newsletter, where there is the opportunity to support him financially as well by subscribing, like a paid subscription to the newsletter over and above the free version. And it's kind of a lot like this podcast, right? You know, we have on riseuppod.com a support the show button, and many of you do with a small monthly subscription, if you will, to the podcast. and it works. And it's a, you know, it's the kind of thing when you're really into something, you tend to join all the organizations. You know, with some of my hobbies, it seems I join every association out there. With bread baking, it's the same thing. You know, you can be a member of the guild and you can support Andrew, you know, and you can support me if you want. So that's a good thing, you know, to kind of keep the community connected and keep it going and keep all this good content coming out. So it's fun to talk about that a bit as well. And of course, in the show notes to this show, you can find a link to Andrew's newsletter if you don't already know about it, so you can sign up either free or paid. And if you go to riseuppod.com, heck, you can listen to over 140 episodes. They're all there. And if you're so inclined, click the support the show button and leave a contribution to the show. There you go. All right. It's been a fun week. It's great to be back. Great to be talking with you again. Got another show lined up already for next week. Until then, work hard. Stay cool if it's still summer where you're living. Stay warm if it's winter. Bake lots. Happy baking. Bye-bye.